This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 178.
They're not easy moments. And then one time there was another thing, another awkward thing that was coming up, and it was a brilliant person that was not behaving well. And I took it to the leader. I'm like, well, just leave it alone because of so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And I'm like, I can't. And then I kept sharing my point of view, and I'm like, I can't be quiet. And then I said, if you shared this with your partner, would they accept this behavior? I said, just do that homework for me. Just take this, take it home to your partner. Would they accept this behavior towards them? And they come back and they're like, yeah, my partner was not happy with this example, and you're right. And I said, look, I'm not being a jerk to be a jerk. I'm trying to hold up a mirror in a way that you're consciously making a choice. And you can choose either way. But if you choose one path, I'll hang with you. If you choose another path, I'm going to disagree. You might fire me again. I might have to walk away. Let me call my husband first, you know. But it's a big deal to get fired. But I think my biggest moments of influence have been through those tougher times where I held up my values, held up their values, showed them a bigger picture.
How can HR lead with courage? What does it mean to have an organization that's both high-performing and healthy? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Most HR teams are executing better than ever, and yet many CHROs are wrestling with the same question. Are we truly creating enterprise value or just delivering excellent support? After interviewing more than 150 CHROs and senior HR leaders, one thing is clear: execution excellence is now table stakes. And while execution earns trust, value creation is what differentiates the best HR teams. That insight led me to create my keynote presentation, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow. This isn't a motivational talk. It's a practical roadmap for helping HR leaders move beyond execution and step into a new standard of leadership, evolving from business partners to true value creators. I've delivered this keynote for HR teams at companies like AbbVie, Nike, Corning, Kohler, and LabCorp. And if you're planning an HR conference or leadership event and want your team to leave thinking and operating at a higher level, visit futureofhr.com to get in touch. Let's design a keynote that meets the moment HR is in right now and helps your team show up differently because of it. And with that, my guest this week is Pat Waters. Pat's an experienced CHRO who has led HR for some of the world's most influential organizations, including LinkedIn, ServiceNow, and UKG. She currently serves as CHRO at Intuitive, a global technology leader in robotic-assisted minimally invasive care. And across her career, Pat has built and scaled HR organizations that operate like high-impact product teams, designed around the needs of the business, leaders, and employees they serve, and always grounded in practicality and purpose. She's also the author of Unlock Your Leadership Story, a thoughtful and original book that draws on fables and folk tales to help leaders communicate more clearly, build shared understanding, and motivate teams through storytelling. It's a must-read for HR leaders who want to have more influence and be inspired. In my conversation with Pat, we explore why HR leaders must demonstrate courage, what it really means to bring a product mindset to HR, why storytelling is such a powerful leadership tool, and her belief that HR does not always need to be in the front of the room to have real impact. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, so feel free to drop me a line on LinkedIn. And with that, here's my conversation with Pat. Pat, welcome to the Future of HR Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. Super excited to have you on the podcast. We had a chance to meet in person for an event that Dean Carter had, and that was really exciting for me because you've been on my list for a long time to have in the podcast. And so when I saw that we're going to be at the same place, I'm like, okay, now's my chance to ask Pat to come on to the podcast. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
In talking to you, I've learned something that I thought was interesting. You've talked about your career brand because you've really become known in the HR space. We'll call HR famous. Maybe that's what I tell my kids. I'm HR famous, not TikTok famous. I don't know if you feel that.
Yes.
It's been accidental. You didn't really seek the spotlight. You weren't trying to be a well-known HR leader, but clearly you are one of the most respected CHROs in the field. And I'm wondering, what were some of the pivotal moments or lessons that kind of helped shape how you lead today and how you show up?
A few things. One is my neurodiversity. I have a lot of empathy for people that think differently. How do you process? Do you like pictures, numbers? I am so comfortable pivoting to bring people along the journey. It's super important to me. I also, because of my neurodiversity, didn't fear asking questions. Questions are my best tool. Helps me put things into my head permanently, right? And as I process, that was a foundational thing. I've had leaders along the way that taught me how to pick myself up from mistakes, big, gnarly mistakes I've made where early in my career as a manager or director, I wanted to be the smartest person in the room. And I realized, nope, that's not the job. The job is to enable people to be great and be in service of the business and help the business, not to show off, I know my numbers. And humility, recognizing the differences of people, recognizing that the journey is just more valuable than the destination half the time with companies. It makes great companies. And embrace all that. I mean, I've learned from others.
Yeah, I think what I hear that thread is a little bit of other focus, not about Pat, but really about helping you to add companies, add value, help others find their voice, add value to a company. And I think that is just really what it's all about. Giving before you get is the key in a lot of ways.
Totally. It is my purpose to give more than I've gotten, to be kind, to have an impact. I was in a debate with somebody when I was at LinkedIn, one of the lead engineering leads. He was struggling with something and he just wanted to riff with me on it. And he was like, I never go to HR. He was dissing the function and kind of me at the same time, but yet he wanted my opinion. And I'm like, look, all I want is that if you spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes with me, you're better served. You're stronger, you're more confident, you have optionality, you have data, you have something that makes you better for having had a conversation with me. That's success to me. I don't have to solve world hunger. I'm not saying I know all the answers, but if you and I engage in something, we'll be stronger together. And he goes, I can do that. And I'm like, right on, let's do that.
That's a powerful perspective. And speaking about LinkedIn, actually, you shared a great story about your interview with Jeff Weiner, who was the CEO at LinkedIn at the time, where he told you that he was looking for a unicorn. That sounds very typical in technology, a unicorn. And you said you were more of a workhorse. Tell us more about that pivotal career moment and how that conversation went down.
I've known him from my Yahoo days, so I'm very comfortable with Jeff. And we were chatting and he wanted me to join as their CHRO. And I'm like, well, what are you looking for? Tell me what you're trying to solve for. And he goes, well, I want a unicorn. All right, tell me more. I don't think I'm a unicorn. And he was like, all right, I need someone to be a business partner to me and the team. I need someone to run the function, the comp, the bend, the recruiting, the ops, et cetera. And then I need someone to interface with us and clients, with the customers, to get engaged in their talent strategies, to get on stage, to be a voice of LinkedIn. And I started to laugh and I said, all right, I can do two out of the three. I'm not going to be your face to the customer. That's not me. I'm an introvert. He goes, no, you could do it. And I said, no, I'm a workhorse. Give me the first two. I got your back. Give me the third. That's going to be hard. And he was like, no, you can do it. He goes, actually, I saw a video of you at Plantronics, funny enough, doing a communication video. I'm like, how the heck did you find that? And he goes, you can do it. Just unlock it. And I said, all right, I don't want to see a customer for 9 months. I'm going to start as a workhorse and see if I can learn how to grow a little bit of a horn. I don't know how much of a horn, but I'll try for you. And that's how it started.
Yeah. And so you got good at it though, I think, right? So that kind of helped a little bit get you out there. It sounds like push you out of your comfort zone.
Totally pushed me. I had another leader, like they would always not believe I'm an introvert. I'm an introvert. I don't want to be on stage. I don't want to be out there in the middle. And one leader said, you should write about it, being an introverted leader in Silicon Valley. And he pushed me really hard. Steve Johnson, who was running UX for LinkedIn now at Netflix. And I ended up posting my first long post on LinkedIn. Like LinkedIn was transformative in my voice. They nudged me. So I'm grateful for them.
Yeah, we're grateful for that for two. And I think that sounds like a great experience. And LinkedIn has been so pivotal to all of us in HR, right? It's a social network for HR people for sure. We all know it. And that's where I first heard about you as well, right? So I think people did appreciate you being introverted and sharing your perspectives. And I think it was a role model for a lot of folks, right? Because a lot of HR leaders are introverted, or leaders in general. Yet we do live in a world that rewards people being more extroverted. And so you've got to flex. That's a good lesson for HR leaders as well, is that even if you feel introverted, there are times when you've got to get out of your comfort zone to do the job. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. And what I tell them, it's not about being inauthentic. So Susan Cain and I were talking about that, being a quieter voice. And I said, it's about using your energy as a gas tank. So if I care enough, I'm willing to give you more of my energy. Like, I'm willing to be uncomfortable a bit, to use my voice, to use my point of view for good, in service of something else. And then I find that the purpose drives me. And then as soon as I'm done using that energy, like, leave me alone. I'm going to get a book. I'm going to walk a dog. I'm going to be in my hotel room, totally quiet. But it's in service of that purpose.
Yeah, it's really helpful to hear that. And I'm sure a lot of people will find that really valuable. The other thing you've been really candid about over your career, and I really appreciate, is the realities of HR leadership, especially in the moments that test our courage, which happens more often than we like to talk about sometimes. You said that to leaders, but especially to CHROs, that we need to have the courage to be fired. Tell us what this looks like in practice. Like, how do we do this? Because this is hard.
Practice. In practice, it is me with my cell phone, with an earbud in my ear, talking to my CEO, pacing my dining room table, I don't know how many times in a debate, saying they're wrong. This is an issue. This is a risk. If you take down X path, Y will occur. There's legal issues. There's cultural issues. And don't save that brilliant juror. What you're about to do is going to be bad. Then I said, look, if you go down that path and they sue, I would support them. Like, I would support their point of view. I don't say join the lawsuit, but like, I'd have to leave. That's how strongly I feel about this point. And I said that, I don't know what cycle I was on around that dining room table. And he was like, you would leave over this? And I said, yeah, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, but I'm going to leave within months, not years. This would be a trust broken, a value broken that I can't go forward on. This means, let's look at it from another point of view, can we? And then he just took a deep breath and we got through it and we aligned. But I was willing in that moment to either get fired or quit. My stomach was nauseous. These are not easy moments. They're not easy moments. And then one time there was another thing, another awkward thing that was coming up, and it was a brilliant person that was not behaving well. And I took it to the leader. I'm like, well, just leave it alone because of so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And I'm like, I can't. And then I kept sharing my point of view. And I'm like, I can't be quiet. And then I said, if you shared this with your partner, would they accept this behavior? I said, just do that homework for me. Just take this, take it home to your partner. Would they accept this behavior towards them? And they come back and they're like, yeah, my partner was not happy with this example. And you're right. And I said, look, I'm not being a jerk to be a jerk. I'm trying to hold up a mirror in a way that you're consciously making a choice. And you can choose either way. But if you choose one path, I'll hang with you. If you choose another path, I'm going to disagree. You might fire me again. You might have to walk away. Let me call my husband first. You know, it's a big deal to get fired. But I think my biggest moments of influence have been through those tougher times where I held up my values, held up their values, showed them a bigger picture. The cost of yes is what I frame it as. If we say yes to what you want to do, this is the downstream impact. It's like that Wall Street Journal. Would you be proud if this is on the front page kind of thing? They're hard times.
Yeah, what I love about that, Pat, I mean, thank you for sharing those stories, because I know those are not easy conversations to have. And what really sticks out for me is that not only are you holding the mirror up, but you're coming from a place of real care. Like, your intent is not to just throw a fit and leave the company or to get your way. You are trying to help the company make the right decision, but there's a red line for you. There's an ethical line of value that maybe was there. And I think as HR leaders, we have to have the courage to say that this isn't something I'd support, or it's going to have this downstream implication. I don't want to be a part of that either. But that isn't always easy. So thank you for talking about that.
Not easy. And I've talked to peers of mine that had to make those choices. And it was hard. It's like, hey, just joined so-and-so and you left in a year. What happened? Oh, not a culture fit. I'm like, tell me more. Because you could tell they're bruised. It's a hard spot to be in. And they had to ultimately leave because they couldn't figure out a path through it that met their values and was good for the employees and good for the company. And I applaud them. That takes courage. Some people left too soon and didn't have the conversation. Like, they made this decision. I go, well, what do you do to influence the decision? Did you lay it on the line, so to speak? I believe our values sharpen as we age through wisdom, through test of times. I've had some testing. We all have.
We all have. But it's actually way more common. We just don't talk about it a lot. I've talked to many CHROs who've had that experience. I've had that experience actually as well. But I think you are, to your point of like, how hard did you push? Did you do everything you possibly could? I think this happens to other support functions as well, for sure. But HR, it happens a little bit more often because a lot of times the decisions we're making are involving people and the culture, and then are sending a really big message across the organization. And really, you have to have that aligned with that CEO. If you're CEO and you don't really see things eye to eye in that way, from a values perspective, it's hard. And that's where I see most CHROs leaving, is because they're just not aligned with that CEO's vision of what the future could look like.
I think there's one path that we should talk and teach the next generation to do more of, is to create a tipping point on the leadership team in support of that CEO. Because not everyone has all the answers. But if you have a team of eight, a team of 10 of us, right around that virtual table, if we choose, like, let's use this as a business case. Here's the brilliant jerk. Here's the this. Here's the short-term decision for the long-term X, Y, Z. Where would our values lie? Maybe even practice before you get in that awkward spot. So when you get into that decision point, you kind of already aligned with your peers. And then the pressure's not all on the CEO. We go to him or her and say, here's our point of view. Here's the path forward that we would support. Give us your decision. I think that will help move the needle.
That's great advice. And you've also talked a lot about building healthy companies, not just high-performing ones, which I think is a refreshing time. We always talk about high-performing companies, but maybe we don't talk a lot about healthy companies. And for you, what does a healthy company really look like? And how do you know when you have one?
That comment, that phrase, I'm going to thank Jeff Weiner for inspiring again. We were doing our vision of values work across the entire company. And it's like, Waters, what do you stand for? You need a tagline. And I'm like, I know I don't. I don't have one. He goes, you need a tagline. I'm like, I'm not just do it. I'm not Nike. I'm not marketing. I'm Irish. I talk in stories. So it took me a couple of months actually to realize that I have a purpose statement that I live by now that keeps me grounded. The other thing I think about is just like, how do you show up as a CHRO? What do you want to be known for in terms of when you walk in that room? And so Jeff taught me a lot about who I am just by probing. I don't think I answered your question.
What you see there is Jeff helped you get to know you a little bit, and a purpose statement kind of maybe came out of that. Tell us more about the purpose statement if you can, or how Jeff did that, which is incredible. You had a CEO that was curious enough to push you out of your comfort zone.
Like he said, what do you stand for as a leader? And so I had to do some work. And then I figured out as a function, if you're going to invest in me, like we're in the talent space, what do I actually care about? So I melded the two. So I came back to him and I said, all right, here's my belief. Here's what I stand for. And I feel really good about it. The other thing I believe is that my purpose is to build a high-performing, healthy company that can scale. That's what gets me jazzed. That's what gets my entire function jazzed. So are you talking benefits healthy? Like, Waters, what are you talking about? Wellness programs? And I'm like, no, I'm talking about respect, belonging, the smiles in the hallway when you're in the elevator. It's like, hey, how was your weekend? I actually pause to listen because I care. I know about your dog. I know about your wife's going to have your fourth child. There's a community there. You can give feedback without worrying about harming anybody. I'm giving you feedback to help all of us grow. Like, it doesn't feel attacking. You have healthy muscles to debate, align, move. If you're struggling and I'm not, I lean in. That's a healthy signal. I use discretionary effort to help a peer out. I collaborate and I change my approach to welcome all. That's the inclusion part. That's like different personalities, cultures, language that I use, learning tips. That's healthy. If I see that in a company, they're going to outperform their competitors in the marketplace.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's an amazing definition. And it sounds like a place we'd all want to work, in a place that feels healthy that way, right? So I love that.
That's what I look for. When I think of healthy, going full circle and the challenging, if the decisions we make create an unhealthy environment, it's on me to show the data, the stories, the impact on employees, our performance, if we allow it to happen. We're going to lose the sense of urgency. We're going to lose trust. We're going to lose discretionary effort. We're going to lose something if we erode culture. And you see it over and over again. Bad behaviors get short-term wins. Healthy behaviors get long-term wins. And most companies want to be in the game long-term.
So well said. You've also said something that I think is fascinating and just every HR leader should really think about. And that's that every time there's a big initiative, I don't want HR in front of the room. The more up there, the less accountability the business has. Tell us more about why you feel so strongly about this.
We're in service of the business. Everything that we do is a business solution. Think of your HCM tools, be it Workday or Oracle or UKG. They're in service of leaders navigating their talent, giving performance, navigating goals, payroll, time, scheduling. The most incredible asset is our talent. Every leader should know that. Navigating that, how you get performance, feedback, how do you build community in a very distributed workforce? Those are business problems. So if you're going to change your performance management methodology, that's a business decision. If those business leaders are not standing up and going, this is why we're doing what we're doing, this is the outcome that we're seeking, then it will fail. It won't get the traction. It won't be trusted. You'll lose. I'm competitive. I don't like to lose. So if the business pulls it, the business dances with me, I co-create with them. It's aligned to strategy and growth and prioritization. We all win. We get a better, healthier company. They should lead.
Yeah, it's such a great point because I think what can happen is that we all want, a lot of HR leaders want to add value and we want to please people and we want to add support. When a business leader brings a problem, sometimes they want us to be a pair of hands and just run with it. Or we're order takers and we call that vending machine HR. And it can feel good because we got something done. But to your point, we didn't co-create it. It wasn't collaboratively designed. And so what happens when maybe they don't get the result they expected? Is HR can take the blame because now they can blame HR. They weren't involved in it. And we get the scapegoat. Or maybe actually what they thought was just a big problem was a symptom. If we had done more time to do the root cause analysis and put some more time into it, we'd have a different solution. And so that's why I always caution folks to not fall into those two buckets and really push back and hard and say, let's co-create this. But I love just that you just bring this point home of they should be up in front of the room talking about it, not us. It's not our initiative. We're here to support, but not to lead it and make that final call.
And I love dancing with the people. When I'd say I want to be your dance partner, it means like, let's pick the rhythm, right? The tempo that we want to have. What's the outcome? What's the vibe you want to create? Let's figure that out. And are we chasing the right rabbit, the right metrics? And are we doing it at the right time? Like, you got to get real clear focus on the absorption rate of our talent. If you're hiring fast, your managers are like full bent on hiring and onboarding and absorbing and engaging their new talent. You can't throw a lot at them. And so you got to be clear and educate, guide, and partner with them. But it should be business led.
And Pat, when I had leaders that really didn't want to lead it, they wanted you to lead it. How do you handle that situation? I guess, you know, for some advice for next gen HR leaders who are listening and may experience that, what are some of the ways you've done and managed that situation?
My head is just ping ponging to a couple of times, like so many times that's happened where I've taken the ball because it's my time to shine and it's my time to show I got skills, mad skills, blah, blah, blah. But the accountability isn't there. You don't get the right traction, the stickiness. So when I leave, the initiative falls apart. So you don't really create your legacy that you want, that we all want, is to leave a company, move on from a role or a company to make it healthier because we were there. If it's purely based on your effort alone, that's moving the ball up the mountain, you kind of miss the mark. Who are your sponsors? Think change management. Get your right stakeholders. Who are the key influencers? Who are your key resistors? Ask them why they resist to make sure you're touching the elephant. Like, get the full perspective. Maybe they don't want to do something now because they're launching a major product or they're going into a new region or we're doing a major acquisition. Now's not the time to change how we set goals for the company and distract them. You're in competition of bandwidth, mindset, initiative. Just be cautious. If you're aligned with the business and you focus on the few things, you're going to do much better.
Good, great advice. Great advice. You also know for using humor and candor to drive accountability with executives, even showing them some ugly data. But How do you create space for those conversations to be so honest while maintaining trust, but also getting people to take that accountability we just talked about?
I live in a glass house. So anytime I share a leader that needs to improve, like think about your employee voice survey, your engagement survey. If a leader has bad scores and I know they're not engaged, not focused on it, I'll use humor and make a statement. Sometimes I'll pick on something that I myself am doing poorly. Like I'm under hiring, I'm not doing, I had a couple mishires, whatever the case may be. And I'm like, look, so-and-so is doing a great job. They're pretty, but you and I kind of ugly right now. I got to get my act together. What are you going to do? Depending on the personality and the leader, I'll either throw myself in the boiling water with them and say, we should strategize together and figure out a way out of this and leverage Joe over there that's doing a great job. Or I'll say, hey, this looks ugly. If you want it ugly, that's up to you. If you need any help making it cute or pretty, let me help. And I try to use humor because they have a lot going on. I may not see everything underneath the hood. And if I give them a little bit of a wiggle room out with a little bit of humor and grace, they will challenge me sometimes. Oh, yeah. I've had a few of like, what do you mean? And I have some of them just chuckle. Like, yeah, I haven't been focusing. Like, how can you help me? Humor helps.
Yeah, humor is powerful. And it's your point of making yourself, hey, put yourself in that boiling water like you talked about. Like, hey, we're in this together. Like, we're not perfect either, but, you know, we probably could do better. Versus coming at them hard of like, hey, look what your scores are. People are not happy. You know, some of that may backfire too. I love that way you handle that. And I think it just takes time, and probably over your years of leadership, you've gotten better at it and be able to read the room, right? Because we probably all made jokes that didn't fly. It definitely happened to me multiple times. So I think that's always interesting to go through that piece. Another thing you've been really doing that I love is that you've been framing HR as needing a product mindset, which I 100% believe part of my value creator model is really innovating like a product manager. But how should HR be thinking about this and building our tools from a product management mindset?
I copy shamelessly from the business. So I think about the employee journey map, like the customer journey map. Companies have been spending millions of dollars to map their customers, from attracting customers, onboarding them, retaining them, and expanding them. Why are we not doing that with an employee? So you can have a product mindset and look at the metrics and manage that pipeline like you would that. Why not? It pays off. The second product mindset that we should have is thinking about what kind of industry you work in. When I was heavily in sales, I use sales analogies. When I'm heavy in tech, I use the tech stack analogy. I immerse myself in how they communicate. So when I reflect an idea, I use their words, their framing to get them to understand. And what I've learned since I support a lot of tech firms and SaaS software or hardware is framing what we do as a product. What's my TOM, total available market, on my employee base? It's all 17,000, or my TOM is my VPs and above. What's my SOM, my served available market? Like, what's my SAM? Like, I'll go through that funnel and say, okay, here's my target audience. Here's my why. Here's my business case. Here's the data, and here's the outcomes and success metrics. And I have a hypothesis based on that. And so let's do phase gate approach or a pilot test and see what happens and get feedback and tweak the product along the way. Neurologically, if we frame something as a hypothesis, as a test, as an experiment, we're more willing to lean in and accept the bugs. If I say I'm rolling out this brand new widget of HR, a new manager training program, a new onboarding, they're going to pick at it. Why didn't you have this? Why didn't you have new backpacks? Why didn't you give me a new pen? Whatever the thing is. But if you say I have a hypothesis, if we change how we onboard your talent, get them to fall in love with the company even more, get them to know the product and the services, know how to set their goals and their vision for 90 days, 6 months, whatever. If we can welcome them using AI, machine learning to help them solve their onboarding issues like benefits and payroll, et cetera. What would that do, that first impression do? What it does for every company, it will change our retention. It'll change your referral rate because I'll invite more friends to apply. There's real upside. I have a hypothesis. Let's see if I'm right. And if you approach it as a product, I've yet to have a leader say, don't do it like that, ever.
Yeah, I think it's a really powerful mindset, because when you have hypothesis like that, you're now learning. You're in learning mode. Versus I think a lot of times we roll products out, leaders expect it to be perfect. They're like, well, if you're rolling this out, you must have thought through every detail, when in reality, that is impossible for anything anyone does. Never. The other thing from a product mindset, I'd love your perspective on it. But if you think about product management, there's times when that product's going to be evolving. You have a roadmap. You're thinking about from a user perspective. What are we really solving? What's the emotional piece? And what I find a lot of times in our HR, we have a leadership development program. It's been the same one for 7 years. There is no roadmap. There is no product. We're just going to keep doing it over and over again versus like, well, how do we sunset that? Is that how, what innovations are we making on that product? Like, we're not thinking about that. Performance management, the same thing. We make changes like year to year because someone was frustrated with it, but not actually thinking about where we're trying to move long term. So I think there's a lot of value in thinking like a product leader.
Let's add on the portfolio management. High impact, low effort do. High effort, low impact don't do. Like it then sunset, automate it, do something like do your SWOT analysis on your portfolio, because you'll find individuals in every org that just holds on because that's my job. It may not be the best and highest use of that resource, of that capital. What can we do different to elevate the impact that we have in the org? Whatever I build today is going to crack in 3 years. I am comfortable throwing away or modifying my work because I will never get it 100% dialed every time. Never. I make mistakes all the time.
We all do. And maybe that's also part of what makes us human, is that we're going to make some mistakes along the way. You know, Pat, you've also, I know your career brand may have been accidental, but you accidentally also decided to write a book called Unlock Your Leadership Story. And it truly was accidental. So I'm going to give you a moment, because I know I've heard the story about how this came about. You were a reluctant author. Give us a little more insight to that before we get into the book. I think I don't want people to think that you're being humble, but you truly, really were kind of this accidental author, and it's a great story.
Because of my dyslexia, I've never, ever thought of writing a book. And my peers would ask me, like, hey, you want to collaborate? I'm like, yeah, no. And I got a call from a publisher and they asked me, hey, Pat, would you like to write a leadership book about HR? And again, I said, no, thank you. Like, I stand on the shoulders of so many amazing HR leaders and partners and CEOs that I can, who am I to write a book about HR? I would never do that. So again, I'm like, no, good excuse. Don't have to write a book because it's true. And then she asked me, she says, well, if you could write a book, what would you write about? What would get you up every morning? And no one's ever asked me that. So anytime people ask me a question I haven't thought of before, I'm like, wow, darn, I got to think about that. And what came to mind is the way I teach and coach, the way I learn personally is through fables and folk tales. I'm like, they're not going to buy off on that. That's like such a wild idea to, here's how you gain perspective. It's the blind man and the elephant, or here's like the three pigs and Goldilocks. Like, so I'm like, ask a few of the executives I've partnered with and along my career, I'm like, what do you think? Remember Goldie? Remember this? And like, yeah, I'm like, that could be fun. And so I'm like, I'll just throw out my wildest idea. They could shoot it down, but it's fun to explore. So I sent it to the publisher. I called her up and I said, hey, Lee, I got an idea. Fables and folk tales. It's how I coach. It's how I lead my life. What do you think? She's like, huh? She bought it. And she was like, why do you write it up? Give me a sample chapter and I'll send it to the editors. We'll sit down. We'll talk about it. I'm like, okay. And so I wrote this thing up within like 24 hours, sent it to her. And she came back and like, hey, we like it. Let's write it. I'm like, what? Okay, now what do I do? She says, well, how long will it take you to write a book? I go, I don't know. I've never written a book. Never thought of writing a book. I go, how long does it have to be? And she was like, I don't know, X number of words, I think 9-10 chapters. I'm like, all right, a chapter a week. And mind you, I was the sitting CHRO when I wrote this book. I don't know why I thought I could do a chapter a week. So I'm like, I could do it in 4 months. Like, I was so naive.
Yeah, that is a crazy story. And so you wrote the book in 4 months. Did you get, I think you got an extension too, maybe for like, you got asked for 2 more weeks or something. It was
2 weeks. Yeah. I got panicked. I'm like, maybe I need a buffer. Maybe 2 more weeks.
I think you've had a lot of employees ask for 2 weeks to, you know, do their performance reviews, right? After 3 months of giving them time to work on that, right? So two weeks is not a long time to write a book. But in the book, you do reinterpret a couple of things I thought really interesting. And one of my favorites was the tortoise and the hare, because you reinterpret it in really a powerful way about shifting the focus from speed to living on your own personal scorecard. And so tell us more about this idea, like what is a personal scorecard and how can we use this mindset to stay true to our values?
Gosh, that's one of my best life lessons. It's just putting on paper in a framework, your values, things that motivate you in your life. And what do you want to be known for by your children? at the end of my day, my eulogy, I want to be kind. I want people to smile when they think of me. I want you to smile when I walk in a room. I've done my best. I've been in service of my community and my family. But what does that mean? And so when tough decisions happen, like, what's your scorecard? How did you show up? What decision did you make? And I remember in the scorecard, I wrote my scorecard down. My son had my first granddaughter and I had a busy job and I'm flying coast to coast. And in the scorecard, it said, I will see my grandbaby once a quarter. So I had a personal bucket, right? Family bucket. And I had a health bucket, a financial bucket, a career bucket. Had a few other things in there, but once a quarter was written down for sure. Strive to meet that commitment because my boys don't live near me. I had a second grandchild, a son. My son had a son and Emmett was born April 1st, a year and a half ago. And I made it to that birth and I'm holding my grandson. I'm crying. That moment hit. And my son goes, Mom, according to your scorecard, because I share my scorecard with my family, you will have met Emmett and Everly, I don't know, he said like 72 times by the time they're 18. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's not what I want in my scorecard. That's not what I intended in my scorecard. I was bawling. And I go, I want a relationship. I want to be called Nana, Nana, Nana. I don't want to be a chicklet on a Zoom or a FaceTime. I want to smell them and love them and hug. Oh my gosh, wrong scorecard. So I changed it. And what manifested was me changing jobs, getting an apartment. My boys picked out an apartment a mile away from both of their families. And I have dinner with my grandchildren about once a week. And they call me Nana, Nana, Nana. My scorecard's better balanced. So I want to live life my way that gives me joy and fulfills my life and makes me a better me. And that's what that scorecard's all about.
I love it. Well, it's a great book. I do encourage people to pick it up because not only is it talking fables, but I think it gives some language to leaders, HR leaders that they may not have had before. And some great analogies because it's not threatening to talk about Goldilocks and the Three Bears or Tortoise and the Hare, the elephant, right? And all the other great stories in there. It makes it a lot easier to have these tough conversations. Last question for you, Pat. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Authentically human. It's just leveraging all the tools and AI and capability and how the company grows, but keeping the human in the middle. Our job is to be authentically human and model the way and show the way, encourage the way.
I love it. Well, that does really encompass you as well. So Pat, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for being authentically human. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again for Pat for sharing what it really takes to build a healthy, high-performing company and lead with courage when values are on the line. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and have more business impact. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus HR thought leaders. We'll be back next week and joined by Brian Underhill, founder and CEO of CoachSource, the world's largest executive coaching firm with more than 1,200 coaches globally. Brian's a pioneer in the executive coaching space and co-author of Coach Me, Your Personal Board of Directors, Mastering Executive Coaching, and Executive Coaching for Results. He has coached hundreds of leaders across industries and helped organizations drive measurable long-term behavior change at the executive level. In my conversation, we'll explore what great executive coaching looks like, how leaders can use feedback to drive real behavior change, and why measurement matters when it comes to leadership development. You won't want to miss this great conversation. Thanks again for being part of our Future of HR community.